in modern memory had a presidential candidate who has this blatantly misogynist a history?
No.
Welcome to the Humanist Hour, the official broadcast of the American Humanist Association. In this episode, find out how Amanda Marcotte bummed out a bunch of utopians, where our next challenge on the pro-life front may be coming from, and why Hillary Clinton and Elizabeth Warren have taken to taunting Donald Trump on Twitter. Any year in which we have the first female major party presumptive nominee for president is going to be a busy one for feminist politics. Even without Hillary Clinton, however, there's plenty going on in the current political discourse that's of interest to feminists. From the misogyny of Donald Trump to the recent Supreme Court decision on abortion, we have a lot to talk about. To cover these topics, as well as Clinton's rise to nominee, Stephanie Zavan talks this week with Amanda Marcotte. Marcotte is a political writer for Salon with more than a decade of watching developments like these unfold. Listen and catch up on the presidential campaigns, online discourse, and the state of abortion rights.
I am here today with Amanda Marcotte, political writer for Salon. We are coming live from Convergence, and you're hearing the lovely birds outside the hotel window here. Nice little cheerful background to talk about politics. Welcome, Amanda.
Thanks for having me and the birds.
So Convergence is the largest fan-run annual science fiction and fantasy convention. You have been here several years now. I don't think people necessarily associate you with geekdom, shall we say, despite the fact that you're sitting here with your Batman t-shirt and your D20 earrings. What is it that you come to Convergence for?
The skeptic invited me a few years ago to talk about politics, science, and pop culture stuff, and it's, you know, been fun, and so I've been coming every year, just paneling on those sorts of things. This year, we're talking a lot about politics and science fiction and feminism and genre fiction and things like that. So there's kind of a lot of crossover between what I kind of write about and the sort of fictional worlds that sci-fi conventions kind of celebrate.
Now, you mentioned to me earlier that you were on a Utopia panel last night and you were kind of the downer.
Which is weird because I think I'm an optimist, but it comes across, I think, to people that have broad, sweeping utopian visions is a bit of a downer, because my whole purpose on the panel was, not intentionally, I don't think they invited me to be this person, but I said, well, you knew what you were getting into when you had me on, was to be the person to be like, look, utopias are not possible because political conflict is inevitable. Like, even in a world where there's a whole bunch of resources and there's no conflict over resources, at the end of the day, people are going to still just be animals that have hierarchies and clashing ideologies. And some people are going to want more and they're going to resent equality. And my analogy was, look, I live in a house with one other person and two cats. You know, if utopia was possible, like, we should never have any conflict within that tiny little community. And yet,
cats are always on you.
Yeah. My cat doesn't want to take her medication. She needs to take her medication. I know that's a really strange analogy, but like, that's the point. Conflict is unavoidable. And cat scratches in this case.
So what were some other utopian ideas that you had to throw some cold water on?
You know, I was also throwing water on the notion that the reason that the Democrats don't do more is a lack of willingness to do so. I think that a lot of people misunderstand having to do political work in a conflict inevitable environment with being overly cautious. And I think that there is a tendency that grew really out of control this election season to simply think that the reason we don't get things like single payer or free college is because we don't ask for them. And I really tried to really kind of argue as extensively as I could that the reality is that just because you ask for something doesn't mean you're going to get it. So, you know, you have to think more strategically than that.
So let's talk a little bit about this political season. One of your beats, obviously, is feminism, and particularly in politics. Has this been a really unusual season? Or are we just talking about the feminist and, well, sexist elements of politics more this year?
Well, I mean, it's inevitably unusual, right? Like, this is the first time ever that a woman's been a major presidential party nominee. This is a uncharted territories in a lot of ways. I mean, the closest we've ever gotten was Geraldine Ferraro and Sarah Palin, and I don't think that the vice president is anything near like the presidential candidate. It just isn't. And I think add on top of that like she's almost certainly going to win. And you know, it's thrown a real, I don't think it's a coincidence that discourse about gender and politics has grown rapidly. And I think it's almost subconscious in a lot of ways. It's a reaction to Hillary Clinton. It's a reaction to the fact that women's political power is growing really rapidly.
This year was unprecedented as well because we had not one, but two female candidates in major parties for president. Do you feel like having Carly Fiorina on the Republican side made any difference there, or did they pretty much ignore her?
Well, they didn't ignore her. I mean, Ted Cruz picked her as his VP, and you can say, and I would argue that that was, you know, obviously like a Hail Mary move on his part to try and get the nomination. But the fact that he thought that would work at all is very interesting, I think. You know, I think that the Republicans are beginning to see that having women in politics is not just a thing that is happening and you just have to accept it, but actually a valuable thing that could actually work for you as a party. Now, you know, the full ramifications of that have not been felt on either side. But I think people are beginning to sort of realize that women's roles have changed in a fundamental way in our society, and there are advantages to embracing that instead of just either resisting it or, you know, just kind of pretending it's not as big a deal as it is.
Do you think we'll ever see a Republican woman running who is actually addressing women's issues as opposed to being that woman who basically fulfills the role that Phyllis Schlafly has fulfilled on the conservative side forever?
Carly Fiorina is an interesting person because she's really an ideologically incoherent person, right? Like, on one hand, she was embracing all the social conservatism that the Republican Party has been running on forever and ever and ever. And that is fundamentally a misogynist philosophy. This notion that it's built on the notion that women's place is in the home and not in the public eye. And then she was trying to somehow square that with her belief that she deserves to be in the public eye and that she's not unique in this regard. She, you know, she felt like a lot of women that shouldn't be something that women should feel like they can't do. I think that kind of ideological incoherence puts a limiter on women, Republican women's ambitions. And we saw that with Carly Fiorina, which is like, either the Republican Party is going to have to somewhat let go of social conservatism, or the women in it are going to have to go full Phyllis Schlafly. And I think the latter is becoming increasingly impossible. It's hard for me to imagine a Phyllis Schlafly running for president. It's got to be someone like Carly Fiorina. Because otherwise, who's going to vote for you, right?
Fair point.
You know, your argument has to be, I'm a competent professional, which inherently requires believing that women have a right to be competent professionals.
Even if you're arguing the otherwise yourself.
Yeah, it's a tough thing. And like, what they've landed on is trying this choice language, right? Which is like, well, you can choose to be a housewife or you can choose to be a professional. And it's like, I mean, that sounds good on paper, but in practice, it doesn't make any sense because nobody tells men you can choose to be a housewife or you can choose to be a professional. And when you think about it that way, you realize, oh, we're not actually treating women the same as men, because nobody would ever be like, you know, George W. Bush, did you ever wish that you'd stayed home with the kids instead? You know? And he probably did. Some days I bet he did.
Clear some brush, take the kids out.
Exactly.
We talk about Trump and racism a lot. I don't think we talk quite as much about Trump and sexism in a general sense, but have we in modern memory had a presidential candidate who has this blatantly misogynist a history?
No. Yeah, I think actually weirdly one of the reasons we don't talk about it as much is because the racism angle is, I think, seen largely in the political science is what's driving his political base, right? The people who vote for him and really support him strongly are racially motivated to do so. I don't think that there's actually been any research I've seen on the gender opinions of that crowd. Not just people who are like holding their nose and voting for Trump, but like people who love him and voted for him in the primary. You know, there's anecdotal evidence that there are a lot of like misogynist men that just think he is the bee's knees. And one of the problems is that the two are intertwined in this way that's very hard to like extricate from each other. People with white supremacist points of view often have male supremacist points of view as well. And Trump, you know, is a really classic example. You know, in a sense, I think the country is finally beginning to realize that racism and sexism are just as much about the people that they privilege as the people that they oppress, right? And Trump, I think, is really helping drive home that message. Putting women down isn't just about putting women down, it's about lifting men up artificially, right? Like someone like Donald Trump, like a mediocrity like him, it's very hard to put your finger on what he has of value besides like he's a somewhat competent insult comedian. He literally just sort of coasts through this world on being a man who luckily inherited some money. I think you see a lot of men sort of like that.
Before this election before you started seeing polls and people actually going out and voting for him, would you have expected that to be a liability for him? That kind of blatant misogyny?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I mean, it shows, I think, something shifted in the right. The way I would put it is a lot of people have these opinions on race and gender, but a lot of people want to think of themselves as good people anyway. And so they often will drape ugly, bigoted points of view in romanticized language that justifies and rationalizes it. Very few conservative men that are sexist are going to say the sorts of things about women that Donald Trump will say, because in their minds, even, they don't hate women. They just think there are roles for men and there are roles for women. And, you know, Trump does too. He just uses choice words for women that don't accept his ideas about what their role should be. I think the shift is in a lot of ways more aesthetic than it is fundamental because of that. Here's somebody who's just sort of saying the things that people would say in private. You know, but they realize we're unsavory and wouldn't say in public before.
You're listening to The Humanist Hour. I'm Stephanie Zavan, and I'm speaking with political writer Amanda Marcotte about feminist issues in current politics.
Why that shift is now, it's hard to say. I mean, I think after 8 years of a black president, maybe a lot of people, and with, a, you know, facing down the real possibility of a female president, I think that 1-2 punch is, I think, causing a lot of people that really thought, I think a lot of them wanted to believe Barack Obama was a fluke. And now it's like beginning to occur to them that he wasn't a fluke. This wasn't a one-off. Our country is changing in very fundamental ways. And we're starting to see people be like, well, then it's time to stop being nice and like start getting real.
And we're seeing a general corresponding rise on the right of some very blatant ideologies, what they're calling like the alt-right and that sort of thing.
Yeah. Moment.
So let's talk a bit about the Democrats, because I think things have been quieter or maybe more hidden or indirect on that front. And so it's been much more contentious in terms of the kinds of roles that sexism have played in politics in this season. First off, as a woman writing about politics and writing about the fact that there might be a woman first as the nominee and then as president and reasons why that might be a good thing or not a good thing, have you felt free to write about that in the way that you generally are free to write about politics? Have you gotten reactions that you might not have expected?
I've gotten reactions that I've never gotten writing about anything else. Let me put it that way. I feel free to just tell people to step off generally, but I think most women don't. So it's a tough thing to talk about. I've been a professional politics writer for over a decade now, and I have never, ever, ever seen people on the quote-unquote left talk to me and act towards me the way they have in the past year. The sin has been both being supportive of or generally positive about Hillary Clinton and daring to suggest that perhaps some of the support for Bernie Sanders, it's hard to put your finger on how much, but God knows it is some, is rooted in not some sort of sudden surge in socialist sentiment for which the polling data shows none in our country, but in fact, a lot of dudes on the left who just will never be able to admit it and will grasp on any straw they can, including claiming suddenly out of nowhere they're a socialist. To, like, fight to keep a woman from getting that nomination. You know, I don't think that that's most Sanders supporters. I think most people who voted for him probably just bought into the idea of single-payer healthcare and free college tuition. And, you know, he put together a really attractive platform of middle-class benefits that he calls democratic socialism. And I think that a lot of people just really like voted for that. And in fact, you know, the fact that his demographic was like white middle class people suggests that, yeah, telling middle class people that they're going to get all these like great benefits is probably a very good way to get their votes. So I'm not saying that it was a majority of Sanders people supporters were sexist, but I think his top limit of what his primary turnout was going to be was a lot lower without that. And he would have been forced out of the primary in the early stages if it wasn't for being handicapped by running against a woman. And simply stating that, simply just acknowledging what should be screamingly obvious, caused a bunch of abuse of me, which only serves, you know, to prove my point. You know, you can just point out something as simple as, like, most Sanders supporters don't like Clinton, but they do like Obama. That's just a fact. And Clinton and Obama are, like, on policy, not... There's no difference. There's no substantial difference that anyone can name. And so what is that difference?
A few places, at least, Clinton is moving to the left of where Obama is coming out of office.
Yeah. And she was to the left of him when she ran against him in 08 on a number of issues, including health care. And so, yeah, if it's just about being on the left, like, these are meaningless words that I think people throw around a lot. And they think sound important, but when you dig into the details, you find out, like, the notion that there's some kind of policy driver behind a lot of this starts to fall apart. Like, there's just not a lot of evidence that Sanders supporters are to the left of Clinton supporters. There's just not.
So you mentioned receiving abuse. I think a lot of people don't have a very clear idea of what those of us online who talk about these things classify as abuse. Are you comfortable giving some examples of what kinds of things you're considering, not criticism, not disagreement, but actual abuse?
It's really tough. And I've talked to other female journalists who, and it's almost all female journalists. I know a couple male journalists who were openly supportive of Clinton that got it, but mostly women got this. And, like, it's tough to, like, explain to somebody who's not at the receiving end of it, because a lot of it is really just, like, mansplaining and condescension and just talking at you like you're a child. You know, in a lot of ways, that kind of sexism is so much more offensive than just doing a drive-by calling someone the C word, because it's basically somebody just self-appointing themselves, like denying your entire career, all your experience, all your research, all your hard work, everything you live your life for, and just rolling up in a ball, throwing it in the trash, and dismissing that all clearly because you're female. And you know, it kind of ends up proving the point that, like, maybe there is a need to dismiss the words of women in this country still to this day. It's 2016 and still, you know. So when I say abuse, I think you get a lot of people calling you mean things and calling you names and all the other vicious stuff. But the stuff that hurts the most is the people that just dismiss you with the wave of a hand as if, oh, you know, you can't possibly have anything of value worth listening to because you're a woman and you're supporting another woman and therefore you're just clearly a cabal of witches or whatever. I'm exaggerating, but you know.
What do you think of the folks who were saying, I really don't like Clinton, I wish Senator Warren were running?
There is a tendency to support women when they have no chance of winning, yes, and never having to, like, put your money where your mouth is. I have joked, I cannot wait for Clinton to pick Warren for her VP because it will prove who meant that and who did not. And already you're starting to see a whole lot of people be like, Warren is a traitor and Warren is a sellout and she's a war criminal and all the same things they were saying about Clinton. And, you know, I think that proves everything. Like, because Warren is far more effective spokesperson for the left than Bernie Sanders. She just is. She has a much more effective track record, especially for having a lesser time in office. She explains her points of view more clearly. She has a grasp of policy and how to communicate about policy that he simply lacks. You know, I think she's a better speaker and politician all over. And I think that she knows how to get into the weeds of the issues that really matter to people. So, you know, it's one thing to be for single payer and free college, which are these kinds of pie in the sky policy things that are never going to happen. At least not the way he's proposing it. But then you turn around and you look at somebody like Elizabeth Warren and her idea of how to go about being a kind of lefty on economic justice issues has been consumer protection and setting up the Consumer Protection Finance Bureau. You know, she basically does all her work on policy of trying to actually fix these, like, institutions that prey on both middle class and low income people and actually make their lives worse. And she has done effective work that is not sexy and isn't these big sweeping promises, but has probably done a lot more to actually help people find financial stability than what Sanders has done.
While we're talking about Warren, I think we would be remiss if we didn't talk a little bit about what's been going on social media with the very strange war between Trump and Clinton and Warren. And just the gender politics of that. Because I cannot imagine another election in which we would be seeing these kinds of exchanges.
The common wisdom amongst the Democratic, like the campaign experts, has been like, and this often came off of watching the Republican primary. So Donald Trump has one trick in his bag, and that's just to sort of be the bully. Like, just sort of mock you and tease you and degrade you until you start to look like an idiot. And he did it really well with Jeb Bush, and he did it really well with Marco Rubio. He didn't do it quite as well with Ted Cruz until the end, and then he just destroyed Ted Cruz. And he can just, he's good at it, I won't lie. He's a very effective bully. The problem with that, and thank goodness for Carly Fiorina, because she proved a theory that a lot of campaign experts had kind of going in, was that method just fails when you run it on a woman. Because now it stops looking like just dudes being dudes and starts looking like sexism. And people don't like it. They really don't like it. And it's true. He tried that to Carly Fiorina. He basically called her ugly. And he can't help but sexualize some of the things he says. And so, you know, that ended up hurting him, and it actually caused her to surge ahead of him in the polls briefly during the Republican primary. So I think that right now, I think what to a lot of people looks like Clinton and Warren just needling Trump for the fun of it, which I have no doubt they're enjoying it. I have no doubt of that. But it's like that is like actually a campaign strategy that's been crafted and is deliberately being employed, which is bait him into saying something horribly misogynist. They definitely are trying to do that. And I think he's riding that Pocahontas thing, I think, because he can't, he can't say it. He know his campaign staff has got to be telling him, please don't, please don't say what you really want to say. So they're gonna do this, and you know what, I say God go with them, because if you had asked me 5 years ago if I was going to ever see like a campaign season where two elderly women were taunting an elderly man who is married to a woman who's young enough to be his daughter for just months at a time, is that that's their campaign strategy, I would have been like, no. And yet here we are, and it's marvelous. I mean, and everybody's on their side. Like, I love seeing the country just be like, yeah, you go get them, old ladies. Like, that's the country I want to live in, where we're just loving old ladies yelling at this guy.
Oh, okay, so there are some serious things going on with gender and politics as well. So, for example, Clinton is campaigning on the end to the Hyde Amendment, which is the amendment that basically says no governmental funding of abortion. There are exceptions, they basically never get invoked, but she wants to end that. Is she making steps, I guess, leftward in terms of what we're seeing on women's issues?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Which is another reason I really kind of struggled against the narrative that Sanders was the one who pushed her to the left, because if you look at her actual campaign strategy, it's clear that from the beginning, regardless of Sanders or whatever, her campaign strategy has been to run a straight-up feminist campaign. In 2008, she had a bunch of different campaign advisors and a much more kind of male staff, and the theory of her campaign was that we're just going to minimize your gender. And then she lost to Obama. And now they're like, well, let's try something new. She has a new campaign staff and totally different strategy. And the strategy has been not only run as a woman, but run as a feminist, like very overtly. And I was at her victory rally in Brooklyn, and the entire speech was about, it was like about suffragettes and about feminists, and they ran this film where it showed all these feminists like of different races and ages and different points in time, you know, doing feminist stuff. Like, it was not subtle in like the slightest, and it was awesome. I mean, I was like crying. And it wasn't that Clinton won, it was that feminism won. So, you know, I see, and I think that feminism is a leftward ideology that I think has much more salience and is much more evidence-based in the 21st century than some of these like old, just very class-centric. Feminism is like a broader lens to sort of look at these issues. So it's not saying like class and economic justice doesn't matter. It's just looking at it from a different angle, where we see like the role that gender and race and all these other things kind of play in these issues. So, you know, something like the Hyde Amendment would be a really good example. Like, it's not being able to afford an abortion when you need one is an economic issue. Not just because you can't afford the abortion, but because you can't afford the abortion, you will often end up having to raise a child that you can't afford. And that it just has these things that it can often cause you to lose a job or cause all these economic problems for people. So, you know, I think that Clinton has embraced a way of looking at these issues that gets into the weeds a little bit more. It's not a big, grandiose, speechifying, like, broad ideology, but it actually might end up helping people. Small fixes can help in big ways, I think, you know, and certainly being able to choose when you have a child, you know, I think that gets dismissed in some circles as a small boutique issue, but for women and for families, it's really not. It is everything.
So while we're on the topic of abortion, we just had a major Supreme Court decision in terms of abortion rights with the whole women's health decision. Can you summarize that quickly for folks who might not be familiar with the issues?
In 2013, the state of Texas passed a broad omnibus bill that was what abortion rights advocates call a trap law, and that's targeted regulation of abortion providers. What that is this way of attacking legal abortion that anti-choicers came up with years and years ago. The notion is that they'll use the fact that the states have a right to pass health regulations on like doctors and stuff to just pass a bunch of laws that look like they're healthcare regulations, but only on abortion clinics. And they look acceptable on paper, but in practice, they're not. So, like, for instance, the Texas law required abortion clinics to have hospital admitting privileges, which sounds good to somebody who doesn't understand the issues. But what you find out when you dig in is that clinics can only get hospital admitting privileges if they admit patients. Hospitals won't give you admitting privileges if you don't actually admit patients. And abortion clinics don't admit patients because abortion's so incredibly safe. So it was like, it was literally a regulation that was unmeetable.
And abortion clinics, for the most part, already had partnerships with other doctors who did have admitting privileges, correct?
Yes, or if you did need to send a patient to the hospital, you could usually send them to ER. So, like, your typical admitting privileges with agreement with a hospital is you have to admit 10 patients a year, minimum. And they do it for financial reasons. There's like bureaucratic money involved with this. Whereas your average abortion clinic might send somebody to a hospital once every 3 years. You know, it's so rare. And if you do have an infection, it's going to be something that the ER can take care of almost always. And often a lot of ER admissions for abortion, they don't even stay overnight. So you still don't need the admitting privileges. You just don't need them. And it was a bureaucratic hurdle that a lot of clinics couldn't get around, and so they shut down. Another one was they required abortion clinics to install full surgical suites. And again, that sounds to a lot of people good, like, oh, you know, that's clean and all that. But you have to point out that a lot of abortions are done with a pill that you take at home, so why do you need a full surgical suite for that? But even the ones that are quote-unquote surgical abortions really aren't. What they are is they actually just expand the cervix and empty out the contents of the uterus, all without cutting. It's like a 3-minute procedure. And you can do it in a doctor's office. It's much safer than getting a wisdom tooth removed.
You're listening to The Humanist Hour. I'm Stephanie Zavan, and I'm speaking with political writer Amanda Marcotte about feminist issues in current politics.
The idea, I think, with the surgical suite law was to make it so expensive to run a clinic that either had to charge people thousands of dollars for what is literally a 3-minute procedure, which currently costs like $300, or shut down. And shutting down was what was happening because it was unfeasible and unconscionable to charge women that much money for. It's so easy that in a lot of places they can do it at home.
And so with the Texas law, what was it, about half of the clinics in Texas closed because of this?
Yes, and if it had gone all the way through, it would have been 33 out of 40 clinics would have closed.
And did this have any effect on the number of people seeking or getting abortions really in Texas?
You know what? That's an interesting question, because the state of Texas's health department, for some reason, didn't release their abortion numbers before the Supreme Court decision this year. Something that the ACLU of Texas is suing them over, or at least, I don't know if they're suing them, but they're certainly, like, prosecuting the case in the media. There is a lot of evidence, though, that women have been resorting to self-abortion in Texas, and I think that that is a twofold thing. One, it became extremely hard to get an abortion. The waits at some clinics were 2 to 3 weeks. And, you know, they also had all these laws like waiting periods and other things that caused women. If you had to travel, you would often have to spend days in this other city, which again, you know, if you're low income and even middle class people, like think about it, if you had to drop right now what you were doing and take a week off of work, how easy would that be for you?
Right.
It would be hard. And like, you know, that's what they're trying to do. And I think, you know, it became easier to get black market abortion pills, especially in Texas, because you can buy them over the counter in Mexico. And you can literally just drive over to Mexico, get $40 worth of pills and abort a pregnancy in your own home safely. And so a lot of women are doing that, like a significant number of women. And can you blame them? Like, I would.
And yet we have laws that have been passed in other states that could make that sort of thing illegal. So, for example, Purvi Patel.
That certainly was a test case. I think the realization that you can use misoprostol to abort a pregnancy has spread all the way through Mexico and Central America and South America. Many of those countries, it's illegal or very hard to get. And so it's so common that people just call it miso. It has a nickname and everything. And one thing that's happened because of that in some countries is like hospital emergency rooms have become these kind of surveillance areas where if you show up and you're miscarrying and you can't tell the difference medically between a miso abortion and a miscarriage, there is no medical difference. So if you show up with an incomplete miscarriage, sometimes in some neighborhoods, some doctors start to get very suspicious and they will call the authorities. And there are women that are sitting in jail who clearly just miscarried. And we know this because they were decorating nurseries or, you know, there's a lot of contextual evidence that shows that they planned to have that baby and then they just miscarried. But because they were single or they were poor or whatever, they're now in jail for murder, for miscarrying at 12 weeks or something. And it's ridiculous. And you can tell with the Purvi Patel case, and that was a case in Indiana where this woman, she did take the pills. She was later in her pregnancy. The fetus died. And she, you know, went to jail for that. You can tell that they're practicing that. They're kind of laying the groundwork for that. Because, yeah, there's no way around it. These pills are going to change everything.
If the Texas law went into effect, these are the kinds of consequences that we were looking at. So there was a good bit of scrutiny on this case. In particular, people were very concerned with what Justice Kennedy was going to decide, because he has a bit of a history on abortion and of being kind of the decision maker in these cases, right?
Yeah, I won't lie. The day that the case was coming out, I was sitting at my computer watching SCOTUS blog, where they like update the stuff, just like chewing on my fingernails. And then they were like, and the decision's written by Stephen Breyer. At what point I was in my office in Midtown Manhattan. I jump up out of my desk and I start running around, punching the air. I was like, and my editor's like, what's going on? I'm like, Breyer wrote the decision. And he was just like, yes. And like, that was before we even knew what it was. But you know, Breyer writing it, he's liberal. Like, you knew it was going to, that the court broke our way, that we won, that everything was going to be fine now. On some level, everything was going to be fine. I had no idea how fine it was going to be, like what kind of decision he was going to write. And it was even better than I wanted it to be. I think what happened with Anthony Kennedy is he just got sick of having to deal with this. Every few years, he's asked again to like sit in on a case on an issue that clearly makes him incredibly uncomfortable. And he doesn't want to deal with, he doesn't want to think about it, he doesn't want to talk about, he doesn't. And, you know, I think that the pro-choice side really worked that angle as hard as they could. You know, they dumped a bunch of briefs on him with extremely personal stories that women had written about how important it was for them to get an abortion and how it saved their lives and their careers and their families and all this stuff, and just really like laid into him and made him feel real guilty. That's what I'm assuming happened. That was certainly what I think they were trying to accomplish with that. And, you know, whatever it did, it certainly caused him to just quietly let the liberals do this. And he just voted yes with the liberal side of the court, but he didn't say anything or like add anything to it. He just simply allowed it. And, you know, I'll take it. I'd better with Breyer writing it than Kennedy, right?
So let's talk about that decision. There was more to it than simply saying, no, that law won't work. There were some very interesting pieces of that decision.
It was a very dryly but straightforwardly written decision where he laid out, I think, as in clear-cut a language as he could, because one of the biggest problems in the past with abortion decisions is that the language was not as clear as it could have been. So one of the biggest problems was, what is an undue burden? The previous case, Planned Parenthood versus Casey, was about, they laid out, you can't have an undue burden on abortion rights. You can pass regulations, but they can't be undue. Well, it turns out no one had any idea what the word undue meant. Like, is making somebody drive 500 miles and, you know, spend $1,000 in travel money an undue burden? You know, that sort of thing. So Breyer basically, in so many words, said he felt undue was a bunch of regulations that have nothing to do with, like, actually making the procedure safer. And that's that. I mean, he was clearly influenced by a piece of legislation the Democrats wrote but didn't pass, but, you know, was one of those bills that you write just to sort of get it out there. It was called the Women's Health Protection Act, and it would have made it illegal to pass any regulation on an abortion clinic that isn't being passed on clinics of that offer similar services. So, like, if you need a 3-day waiting period for an abortion, you need it for a colonoscopy. You know, that sort of thing.
Right.
And while he didn't say anything that straightforward, which I kind of wish he had, he certainly implied very strongly that the test for what is undue is going to be a lot higher now. The state of Texas was asked to prove and failed to prove that a single woman's health care improved by these regulations. And obviously the pro-choice side offered substantial evidence that it actually degraded the quality of healthcare for women. Because the decision focused so much on this, the hope is, and I'm not a legal expert, but I've seen other legal experts say this, the hope is that all these other regulations are now going to be held to a new, stricter standard. So things like a 3-day waiting period or a 1-day waiting period or whatever, does that improve the women's quality of healthcare? No. Now it's going to be a lot harder to defend that in court because the precedent is, does it actually improve the level of healthcare? So keep your fingers crossed. We might start seeing trap laws of all sorts fall.
Well, and we've already seen the court decline to make decisions in very similar laws that have been passed around the country. Wisconsin, for example.
Yes. Yeah.
What other kinds of laws are there out there currently that, you mentioned the waiting period. Are there other things that we're really hoping to see fall?
Well, my list is mandatory lectures. Right now, in a lot of states, doctors are required to either speak to women or give them a pamphlet that has often a lot of things that are flatly false in it. Like things like abortion causes breast cancer or depression or raises your risk of suicide. Those are all lies. And in many states, doctors are required to tell women that. Now, with this new decision, I struggle to see how, with these new standards, you can argue with a straight face in court that it somehow helps women to lie to them about their healthcare needs. That's going to be a tough one. So I hope that falls. Waiting periods, mandatory ultrasounds. That's an interesting thing because the mandatory ultrasounds in a lot of states are on top of or required to be done in a way that's different from what a doctor. Because when you get an abortion, a lot of the time a doctor does do an ultrasound, but they usually do it quickly. And there's not, like, a lot of efforts they try to do it with a minimal amount of, like, touching your body and shoving a vaginal wand in there and all this other stuff. Like, they want it to be as comfortable as possible. And the laws are written in a way to make you do the most uncomfortable kind of ultrasound possible, that it's longer than it needs to be, it's more intrusive than it needs to be. They require, like, right now, a lot of doctors just do the over-the-tummy one to see how big it is, like, in some states, they basically require the vaginal wand one. So, it's so obvious when you actually start to see what the difference is between what the law requires and what doctors will do, that the purpose of the law is to humiliate and embarrass women. And I think that hopefully, you know, having doctors say, we do it this way and the law requires us to do it the other way is going to be a problem. The other one that's really big is a lot of states passed a law requiring doctors to do the abortion pill by the FDA regulations or the FDA recommendations, not regulations. And those were written in the 90s and they hadn't been updated because they often don't update these recommendations. And it turned out the old abortion pill recommendations were wrong, that the doses were too high, that the expectation that you had to be in the doctor's office so many times was too much. And so literally, these states were passing laws saying that doctors had to give women a higher dose of drugs than they needed, which is dangerous and bad for your health and often makes the abortion less effective, which is strange. So the FDA, in an unusual move, updated their recommendations. And that actually caused a lot of those state laws to become invalid. And a couple states, or at least one state, I think, actually then repassed the law saying that they had to follow the old recommendations. So that will be difficult to argue. You're like, no, we want them to do this like kind of abortion that the FDA says is wrong. Like, these arguments are just harder to make.
So do we have any sense of where the new strategies to restrict abortion, particularly legislative strategies? Did the people trying to restrict abortion assume that they were going to win this case before Scalia died? Or have they been working on strategies that, basically, what are we going to need to look out for?
It's a really interesting question because I don't know. I have a couple suspicions, though. So the architects behind this strategy that took it to the Supreme Court was a group called Americans United for Life, and they're a lot like ALEC in that they write model legislation, and so a lot of these laws, they wrote them, and state legislatures passed the model legislation that they wrote. They have been in conflict with some of the other anti-choice groups out there, and there's been some dispute for a couple of years now about whether this was the way to go. And then a couple months ago, the president of AUL just quietly disappeared from there, and now they have an acting president. And I don't know what's going on there, but I do wonder if they knew that this was going to fail them, that they had put a decade of effort into a failed strategy that was going to set them back a decade. And one of the reasons I think that they don't know what to do either is, like, right now it does seem like they're in chaos. Like, right now a lot of the energies are aimed almost at random at this accusation that Planned Parenthood sells baby parts. Like, the fact of the matter is right now they're kind of marshalling around what is functionally a right-wing urban legend, you know, put forward by a bunch of hoaxers. That's not a political strategy. That is not an effective political strategy.
Although we have seen some defunding at the state level based on that.
Yeah, but it's not like an organized strategy. It has all the hallmarks of being something that they sort of landed on because they didn't know what else to do right then. Like, all of a sudden this group called the Center for Medical Progress comes out of nowhere with these wild accusations that are obviously lies. And the fact that so many, like, conservatives got on board right away says to me that they were like, well, what else are we going to do? I really do think they don't know. And, you know, it's clear to me that one of the things that the anti-choice movement has been wanting to do, and they've been turning up the volume slowly but surely in the past decade, has been to really kind of fight contraception as hard as they do abortion. And that's a much harder sell. And so this Planned Parenthood baby parts thing really is kind of their first real strong effort at that, I think. And I know that that sounds strange because it's all abortion chatter, but the defunding efforts are aimed at contraception. And so that's really what they're trying to do, but I don't know if it's going to be effective because I don't see any sign of organization or having thought this out or having really had a meeting and asked the hard question, is the best way to go about what we want to do backing like an obvious lie that any fool can see is a lie? And then just organizing our entire movement around that, you know?
So we might actually be looking at real progress for a little while here.
I hope so. I mean, I don't want to undersell the danger of defunding Planned Parenthood. It's hurting Planned Parenthood in a lot of places. Like, women are losing access to health care. But as, like, a political strategy, I think it's going to fail. Like, every state that defunds them pretty much so far ends up getting sued, and then the government forces them to reinstate the funding because they haven't actually made a legitimate argument for discriminating against Planned Parenthood. Like, and on top of it, it's so easy for a judge to see that nobody else is stepping up to the plate to provide what Planned Parenthood does, in part because, like, our low-income health clinic system in this country, you can't even call it a system. It's, like, such a patchwork sort of, it's barely a system. I don't even like using the word system. It's not equipped to handle. Like, Planned Parenthood is a nationwide, like, clean, standardized, you know, clinic that women can go to and get kind of a really like expected high quality level of care. And everybody else who's providing healthcare for low-income people just needs them to be there so that all the other work can be done. And if they disappear, that's like kicking a leg off of a chair. You know, it will fall. And everybody knows it. And, you know, you see a lot of conservatives say we don't need Planned Parenthood because these other clinics can handle it. And these other clinics are like, no, we can't. No, we can't.
Well, excellent. I actually feel much, much more optimistic about politics than I did when we started this discussion. So
good, good. That's my hope.
Thank you so much, Amanda.
No problem.
As always, we value your feedback on the show. Have a comment or question for today's guests? Have a suggestion for a guest you'd like us to interview? Email us at humanisthour@americanhumanist.org or call our listener feedback line at 202-618-1371. Thank you again for listening to The Humanist Hour, the official broadcast of the American Humanist Association.